Glassroot. I'm delighted to have this chance to talk to you. I've seen you from a distance and known about your life on this campus for a long time, but never really gotten to talk to you about it particularly. And so I have lots of questions, and I hope to learn some things. Now, first of all, you were here both as a student and then, of course, with a long career as a faculty mm-hmm. person. I'd like to start with your student years, if I could, and then we'll build in progression. When were you here?
I came in the fall of 1930, just after the fire. I came as a sophomore because I'd had a year of normal training at Detroit Lakes and then taught a rural school for a year.
Well, now, I'm curious, what was the normal training in Detroit Lakes?
Well, the normal training departments are very common in Minnesota. There were, I think, in every town of any size, and Fergus Falls, Detroit Lakes, and Park Rapids, Wadena, and I'm sure many other towns of that sort would have them. Their purpose was to provide teachers for the rural schools, which had a continuing demand because I suppose most of them were young women. In fact, it must have been 90%, 95% of them or more, and then, of course, they'd keep getting married. And
then they couldn't teach.
They couldn't teach in those days if they were married, and so there was a continuing demand. And to supply that demand, at the normal school or teachers' colleges at that time, they did have very healthy rural education departments. They'd give a two-year course or sometimes a one-year course also, but these normal training departments, which originally were the fourth year of high school, when Tessie Murphy, who was here in 1905-6-7, was a Sauk Center, you would get those. I don't think she took one of those, but she may have, but they originally were the fourth year of high school, combined with the fourth year of high school.
They weren't connected then with the normal school at Moorhead?
No, they were not. They were an independent thing, but they'd have a single teacher who would have a group of from 12 to 20, I suppose, usually 16, and would give the students an intensive program. It would include some theoretical work and pedagogy and so on, but primarily a review of the basic subjects like language and grammar, and I suppose a little literature, history and geography, and so on, the subjects they would teach in high school.
So you did that for a year in Detroit Lakes?
Yes, I did.
Now, you came to there from where? Where did you come there from? Were you from Detroit Lakes?
I grew up in Detroit Lakes, yes. We moved down there in 1922 when we had retired. My father retired from the farm. He'd homesteaded out here about 12 miles from here near Horace in 1878, but he kept breaking his legs, getting very badly crippled, and when he was 65, we left the farms to my half-brothers to farm and moved off first to the little town of Horace. There was no high school there at that time. There were no busing at that time. So in order to find a place where there was a high school, we would have moved in Moorhead or Fargo, but since I had a cousin in Detroit Lake, went to visit, and my mother liked it, and we moved down there.
Well, now, are you the only one from your family who went on to college, then your half-brother's farm?
No, I had a half-sister. I had two half-sisters who were rural school teachers before me.
And they went to the Detroit Lakes finishing?
Well, one of them did. The other one, before we moved down there, went out, took another way of doing it. You graduated from high school like Sheldon, like one of my older sisters did. Then you'd go to Valley City or one of the other teachers' colleges in North Dakota, or normal schools. Mm-hmm. And get a course, it'd be a 6-week or 12-week course, and then go out and teach country school.
Well, now, you went to 1 year in Detroit Lakes then, and then did you teach for a year and then come to Moorhead?
That's correct.
Now, what made you want to come back to college?
Oh, I wanted to go to college in the first place, but if you're the 10th in a family of 12, you can't quite do what you choose to do there. No funds for going to college, so I had to scramble through my own way.
Well, now, when you came to Moorhead, what did you have in mind? What brought you to Moorhead? I suppose was accessible because it was within financial range.
Well, there are a couple of good reasons for it. One, they'd accept my year of normal training as a freshman year of college. That was the primary one. And besides, I had discovered we had a series of programs in Detroit Lakes High School in the late 20s in which various high school teachers would tell about their college experiences. This was highly interesting to the kind of high school students, and the intention was, of course, to interest high school students in going on to college. And a number of our top people were from Carleton, and they told enormously interesting stories, but I never occurred to me that Carleton was a possibility. But Morehead State did seem quite reasonable. I'd known about the normal school and later on the teacher's college for years, of course, but when I discovered that they gave four-year degrees at Morehead,
that's what drew you.
There was no question from then on. That was obviously the place for me.
And that had only been happening for about 5 years by then, isn't that
yes,
right?
Yes, it was very recent. And I guess I was a junior in high school, senior when I discovered that we had a couple of people in the faculty who had actually taken their degrees recently from Morehead, and that this was quite possible.
What was it like, the four-year program? What constituted that four-year program when you came then? What kind of requirements? And could you do anything besides get a teaching diploma?
Well, no. It was only one degree, and it was a teaching degree. You took the education courses. Of course, everyone did. There wasn't anything else. Nonetheless, I suppose some of the people really had other plans, though. Even they planned to temporarily, and teach temporarily perhaps as a stepping stone. But there were a good many of us that came to Morehead, I imagine, in the early 30s, and it was a general purpose college. It was in lieu of a liberal arts college, and we were quite frankly far more interested in the liberal arts aspect of the college than the pedagogy. Mm-hmm. Which, many of my fellow students were frightened by the pedagogical work, especially the practice teaching. Not I, because I had already taught, and teaching had no terrors for me at all. Perfectly easy thing to do, and so I had some advantages when I came, because that was held up before these people as something. They were very rigorous about their teacher training requirements. And
who were some of the teachers who stood out as highlights?
At Morehead?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose C.P. Archer was one of the few had doctorates that time. I think we had only two in 1930, A.M. Christensen. And both of them had degrees in education from the University of Iowa. And I believe they were the only Ph.D.s we had. Christensen, a curious thing, he directed the band and he only taught psychology. Curious combination, but one of the things that was going on at Morehead, since it was just emerging from a normal school into a four-year college, is beginning to develop its extracurricular activities and its honorary and not honorary clubs and fraternities, sororities, that sort of thing. my friends and I were intensely interested in things of that sort, college life, that is. Mm-hmm. And there had been a fair amount of college life at Morehead, even normal school days, but with a larger proportion of men. The greater possibilities and the faculty that was geared up to teach in the various academic departments, the thing that was happening. We were determined to make it into a real college, and we were very much aware of the fact that normal schools were not. They were a different kind of institution.
Were there faculty as well as students who were intensely involved
were,
in that activity?
Yes, they were. Joe Kesey was getting his degree little by little from Harvard. He didn't get it until the late 30s, and Byron Murray was getting his from Iowa in English. Those two were certainly outstanding. I worked with very, very much. There were other people who were very good, who never did take doctorates. For instance, Virginia Fitzmaurice, later married Walter Grantham, and in French and Spanish, and Maud Hayes, who had been here a long, long time. She was quite old.
She
taught. She was chairman of the English department.
Okay.
Had been for some time. She was an old-fashioned elocutionist, actually, but she was a very dynamic personality. She'd go to England fairly regularly. She's a Southern. She was a Southern woman, and had a great sense of humor and a magnificent personality. She was a very strong personality. So in a very different way was Miss Leonard, who taught mathematics, Catherine Leonard from Vermont, and quite a different, sort of a rigid personality, self-contained. She was the whole mathematics department, of course. Cass Ballard had been here the longest of any. He'd been here since around 1900. He taught all of the sciences when I came. We did add Carl Parsons, so he had a degree, I think, possibly from Michigan in chemistry. While I was at college, he must have come in 31 or 32. Flora Frick, who'd come here about 1920, was in physical education.
Men and women, or just women?
Pardon me?
Did she teach both men and women, or just women?
No, women. and Catherine and Jessie McKellar, very much a lady. But Flora Frick was a sarcastic individual who scared the daylights of a lot of people, but she's very warm-hearted, actually. She, interestingly enough, had written her master's thesis in German. And she was supposed to go over and visit Germany in 1914, she told me later on, but the war sort of stopped that. She didn't get over until in the late 50s.
Well, now, did she take her work in Germany then, or why
I don't know for quite sure, but I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
A physical education master's degree written in German.
She wrote her thesis in German. I suppose the Germans, of course, did some remarkable work, the Turnreins and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember that I ever asked her just why. That's certainly uncommon. I knew Bud because by that time I'd come back to teach, and I was chairman of the Division of Language and Literature, and I wanted to get in another language besides French and Spanish, and I wanted German. And she volunteered. She wanted to teach German. It's just before she died, actually, while teaching in the middle of that year. But she wanted to teach German.
So you learned German from her?
No, I'd learned German in the Army, but I mean, I had her teach. I wanted German. I wanted to get it into the program.
Oh, into the curriculum.
Yeah, I wanted to get it in the curriculum.
So Flora Frick taught German.
She taught
at the end of her life.
One. Yeah, at the very end of her life, she taught German. And introduced German and taught it in conversational German, taught it the way she wanted to.
Mm.
Because a very different kind of a person took over from her after she died and was very traditional German, and they hadn't learned it that way, so she was.
So Flora Frick may have been more contemporary in our sense
of
the
word. Yes, she was, far more. And she's a very dynamic person. The most dynamic person of all on the campus is Sliv Nemzik. I should have begun with him because Sliv Nemzik unquestionably is one of the strongest, maybe the strongest person ever connected with the college, in my estimation. A tremendous
person. For what reason?
Well, he just had enormous strength of character, I suppose, and he had great hopes for the college. And there are people who are just a jock, just a coach, but he was far more than that. He was very much concerned every now and about how the college was going, that it was not dynamic enough. I got much involved with college publications at the beginning, and I used to go see Sliv and periodically to interview him about something, and he'd confide my, he said, I tell you Glassroot, and then you get very profane. Blankety blank, 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 blank. Somebody's got to protect the integrity of the blank, blank institution. And he was much concerned about it, you know.
And he would tell you this even though you were only 19 or 20 at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. No, not at all. That's Sliv on level with anybody, you know, there's any question about it. Mm-hmm. There's too many old women here are both sexist. And, well, the old normal schools were like that. They were filled with old women.
Well, now,
both sexist.
Okay, well, that's a good question, though. What was the proportion of men to women in the student body or the faculty at that time?
The faculty... I really never thought about it in the faculty. I suppose men were outnumbered in the faculty also, even then, though I didn't think of that in the courses that I took, because supervising teachers in the campus school and so on were all women. But it was shifting steadily in the direction more and more men.
Mm-hmm.
But that proportion was not too bad of the student body. At the time that Morehead became a college, I suppose there were less than 50 men. In the 20s, I suppose they must have ranged between 25 and never quite got up to 100. But by 1930, we did sort of a milestone. I think we had 100 men, mm-hmm. and that is our high point.
And but how many women?
About 500. So. By the time I finished 3 years later, we had a little over 200 men, mm-hmm. and we had still had about 500 women. So we had, I think our total enrollment before my last year in college was 700, and 200 men and 500 women. And that was not, that seemed to us a very promising.
It's a curious thing. I mean, in a real way, mm-hmm. what's happening in this period of mm-hmm. history is the attempt to equalize it again the other
right.
direction.
Yeah.
Did you have, Slim Nemzik saying there were too many women of both sexes on the campus. Were there a lot of people who were very much aware of that disproportionate ratio and working to attract men to the campus?
Well,
was there an
Slim
active program?
Well, Slim was nothing anti-feminine about
no.
that. It's just he just people who were not, didn't have enough gumption, is
yes,
what he was talking
of course,
about.
Of course.
And no, we were very much very conscious of the fact that we thought that the larger proportion of men we could get, the better chance we would have of becoming a real college, because a great many of the women were, a large proportion of them were merely interested in getting their diplomas and going mm-hmm. out and teach. There were some who were very dynamic.
Who were some of the students you remember?
Oh, at that time? Well, I suppose the most dynamic of them all was Johnny Ingersoll, who served two terms as president of the student council, a student commission, we called it. We
Johnny
had a commission
Ingersoll?
Time. Yeah, Johnny Ingersoll of an old Morehead family. And Johnny Ingersoll was unquestionably the outstanding student leader by far. He was elected president, I think, as a freshman, which is most unusual, and then stayed on another year because that was during the time of the fire. And when you had to rally support at the college in order to preserve the college's existence, Johnny took a very important role.
What did he do?
Well, just rallying the students to not desert and go to other places, because we were hard put. You see, we had to crowd into Weld Hall. We had practically, that's the only building we had, academic building we had left. The two old dormitories were, could be used to some extent. I remember I had a French class in one of the rooms off the lobby, and the president's office here in the registrar's office was in the first floor of Wheeler Hall. And there was a basement room that was used for some classes. We built a temporary building was built right next to Weld Hall, which was used for physical education and as a kind of a student union and an exchange and everything, all-purpose building, a one-story building. We later on called it the Sheep Shed because. Well, the other, outside of Johnny, I suppose the other people were the Montana sheep herders, and we called them, they were not, of course, but a fellow named Ray Johnson had gone out there to coach and had an extraordinarily successful basketball team, which was a runner-up for the basketball championship in Montana from the little town of Manhattan. And he had to come back to finish his work. He lacked his last year of college. He came back to do that and at the same time act as assistant coach to Sliv. He didn't have any assistant coaches. And he brought his team with him. This was Chet Gilpin and the two Robinson brothers, Bill and Buzz and George, and Hank Boer and the two Rugemer brothers. That's all I can remember.
Did they constitute the entire team then, or were there places for locals as well?
Oh, yeah, there weren't enough of them. There were locals also. Concordia at the time had the team that had won two successive years, had won the, from Morehead High, had won the Minnesota State High School championship in 28 or 29, that whole team, and Nash went over to Concordia. So they had a built-in, very fine team.
Did Moorhead play Concordia in those days?
We played them five times.
How did we do?
1 year. We won three out of five in 1 year. The year before, they won three out of four, but I think it was, or two out of three, something like that. But the 1 year, I think 31-32, we won three out of five. The games were played in the old armory, which is a building now used by Francis Peterson Automobile. They put a new front on it, but that was our. There's almost no room for spectators, and everyone in town wanted to see this because they were crowded in. Tremendous excitement. Well, these are my close friends, and a very lively outfit.
Did you play sports too?
No, I played tennis only.
You played tennis.
I was not an athlete, and I got out of high school very young, and I had not involved in athletics.
You hadn't grown
tennis.
Yet.
No, that's true. I hadn't. But there were a good many of my debating friends, a couple of boys named Thompson Ward and Gorman Thompson from the little town of Goodrich up near Thiefer Falls. Kenneth Johnson, these were my debating friends. Don Bird, that was my from Detroit Lakes and got a doctorate from University of Southern California in speech. Some aspect. He was a listening expert. Taught at Stevens College for a while. Died rather tragically over 30 years ago.
Hmm. So you debated that one of the
Of
the big extra. Was that an important extracurricular activity?
Very. Yeah. We thought we'd go on debate trips. We debate Carleton and St. Thomas as well as St. Cloud, Winona, and so on. Mm-hmm. We went down into Wisconsin. We go on debate trips, that seemed very exciting for us. And yeah, it was a lively activity.
Do you
Byron
remember
Murray,
any of the questions?
Byron Murray, yes, we debate unemployment insurance, for instance, one. Mm-hmm. And that seemed very socialistic. That was 1 year. Free trade, I think, was a topic like that. Those are the ones I remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, this was the Depression, after all, and while you were here,
before,
Roosevelt came
before
in.
Before FDR, yeah.
Yeah, but FDR came in while you were in college.
Yes,
so.
He did.
So was there an impact of what was happening in the country on what you were doing? I mean, obviously, those debate questions suggested.
Yeah, right. But you see, it was these were being suggested as theoretical ideas, which seemed quite far out, you know, and quite far away. The idea of unemployment insurance seemed pretty radical. And to try to convince, prove that this was feasible and this was a real possibility was a tough job.
Hmm. This was what year now, 19?
This was 1931, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a year for that.
But there must have been, debaters usually use sources in the magazines and the journals and so on.
Right.
I take it that was being written about quite a bit.
Yes,
anyway.
It was being discussed because this was after the 29 crash, mm-hmm. of course, and I began to feel increasingly. My two interests in college, there was a greater interest in debate. It was in journalism, because when I was teaching, I was very hungry for college, you know, and when I took that year of normal training, instead of coming to college, I was one young man amongst 15 girls, and there was no activity. It was just drill on these essentials, which is no particular problem for me, but I was very hungry. I went through high school without being much involved, because I was too young. I was 16 when I graduated. And these things interest me very much. When I discovered Donald Byrd was had been made the editor of the paper at Morehead State, and I knew Don Byrd from my hometown. Well, there's some possibilities. If he can be, as a sophomore, be editor of that paper, there's that'd be a place for me. So I came up, I plunged into this activity. Mm-hmm. Within a few weeks, Byron Murray was teaching journalism classes. Mm-hmm. And I took some of those classes and began to work on the Mystic paper. The Mystic had been founded in 1926. There had been an earlier paper at Morehead called The Normal Red Letter, started in 1900, just after Frank Weld got here. I have a copy of the first issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long that lasted, maybe some time. It was a kind of a feeble publication. But the Mystic, which we printed in our own print shop, we didn't have a line type machine. We had to have that done commercially, but we printed the paper in our own shop. Because the first aspect of Morehead that did prepared people to get into high school or junior high school work was industrial arts, including at Morehead printing. I don't know why, but they one of the subjects they taught, they had a print shop and presses. And
I was probably proud of the whole progressive education movement, getting people into career fields where crafts that they could practice were in.
You know, in the Minnesota high schools, and the high schools were developing and changing enormously in the period just before and after World War I, and then through the 20s. The laws were passed requiring everyone to go to high school until they were 16, meant that a great many people who had not gone to high school before were now going to high school. Some of them very unwillingly. And I can remember when I was in junior high, a lot of these big alumni just didn't want to be in school at all. They were very hard to handle.
That's a whole influence of John Dewey and the progressive school, but also making the school practical.
That's right. But the Morehead hadn't turned out people who would teach on that level, in the secondary level, except in industrial arts. There may have been some other field, but I can't remember what it was. Perhaps music and home economics. Now, there was home economics at Morehead at that time.
Yeah.
And there were people teaching on the high school level who did not have degrees at that time in those special areas, like industrial arts, music, and home economics, perhaps, or others.
Well, now, were other things added in the 30s that for high school teachers? If you had a four-year degree, presumably you could teach high school and could teach.
Oh, yes, of course. By the time I got here, they were giving, they were preparing high school teachers in practically all the fields.
Mm-hmm.
The first ones I knew at Detroit Lakes came in the sciences. I think my biology teacher had gone to Morehead, the girl from Glendon, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I went off on that industrial arts thing because it was the first aspect of the college, which was first specialty of the college that did allow people that wanted, young men, for instance, who wanted to get into the secondary level, not the elementary level. The way to do it was through industrial arts. And one of them, the aspect was printing. This is the basement of Weld Hall, which had a great deal of machinery down there and besides the print shop.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you started working with newspaper. Did you do some of the printing itself, or did you just do copy and give it to someone who did the printing?
Well, we worked in the print shop. No, we were not supposed to be monkeying around with the printing at all. That was a job for the printers. People were taking printing.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, we did. I learned to set type, set heads and that sort of thing, fiddle around because it fascinated me. And we were all crowded in there, and we were right next door, journalism class right next door to the printing press itself. I learned that theoretically, but then began working, and within a few weeks after I got to college, I don't know, maybe a couple of months, I was associate or assistant editor of the Mystic and became editor the next year.
Was it a weekly or daily or a monthly?
It was a weekly.
Weekly.
It was a weekly, and then the next year, the editor of the annual.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that time called a praeceptor, which means Latin teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We finally, one of my sister was here in the late 30s, 37 or 38, to change that to the dragon, because earlier in the century, Latin had been taught at MS quite widely. In fact, there were two different programs here. There was a Latin course and an English course. And you could take 6 years of Latin at Morehead. In fact, Livingston Lord was a good Latin scholar, but that had gone, and it was beginning to disappear from the high schools, I suppose, though Detroit Lakes High School was still teaching Latin, 4 years of it.
Mm.
But
so they got 4 years in high school and 2 more years at Morehead?
No, they would, they would actually use, in the early years of the century, and this goes beyond my own experience, of course, but They would come to Morehead without going to high school sometime. They'd begin. They would come here. It was a combination academy and normal school.
But they could study Latin here then.
Oh, yeah, study Latin here.
Now, what else did you do? You edited the yearbook. You
yearbook
edited the school
yearbook
newspaper
and the annual, and I played.
Well, I suspect those were considered prestige jobs.
Oh yeah, they were very important,
mm-hmm.
and they are important in a college of that sort. They were at that time, in high school and in college. That is, a successful newspaper will tie the other activities together and keep up what we call college life or high school life.
So you consciously had as your goal then making this place a college showing that in the publications
that
of
was,
the college.
That was our prime aim, I suppose. It interested us more than the academic work itself. The academic work we took seriously if we were forced to take it seriously. Seriously enough, depending on how rigorous it was. Sometimes it was. Joe Kesey, for instance, teaching political science courses and finishing his doctorate at Harvard was a very stern taskmaster, and you really had to bear down. He taught courses like constitutional law, for instance, or America Foreign Affairs. I remember one of the amusing things that when I was in college, and Joe Kesey was teaching American diplomacy or something of that sort, it may have been some. Anyway, Norman Thomas was running for president in the fall of 1932, and Kesey found out that Thomas was coming through Fargo and was going to stop and speak on the back platform of the train, which they used to do. And the last one to do that, I think, was Harry Truman in 1948. So he thought it would be good for us to go over and hear Norman Thomas. So we did, and Norman Thomas converted us all to socialism, my friends and I, and debaters. We all came back socialists, because we were absolutely charmed by him, because he was a magnificent speaker.
Did his whole class go? Did a lot of the students go, or just the few of you?
This were, I suppose, six or eight of us. But we were the student leaders, call them, mm-hmm. the debaters and the people who ran the publication. Mm-hmm. We tend to be the same group, a fairly small group.
And all men.
Well, mostly, yeah, mostly, not completely.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a mock election in the fall of 1932, and we got more votes for Norman Thomas on a socialist ticket than he got for FDR. Actually, because the Republicans beat it, it was the old traditional Republican area.
Mm-hmm.
And Hoover won the mock election, but we got more votes than FDR did. We were stumping around campus for socialists. National Organized took us very seriously and tried to line us up later on. We weren't quite that serious about it.
Even though you weren't quite ready to vote in a real election, you weren't.
I became 21 just 2 weeks before the election.
So you voted?
Mm-hmm. I voted in the fall of 1932 for Norman Thomas. I just got just in time.
That's a wonderful beginning.
I thought it was. I kept voting for him during the 1930s. And heard him a number of times.
Well, now that means that you took those debating issues like unemployment insurance and so on, or unemployment compensation, fairly seriously.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, we took them seriously. Couldn't take FDR quite seriously at first because it didn't seem to make sense. But
did any other political leaders come to campus? Was there much? You had a mock election on campus,
mm-hmm.
which suggests a good deal of interest in the election.
Right. Right.
Was there a strong sense of the depression and of the crisis in national life that was on the campus?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. It hadn't deepened to that extent yet. You see, we were used to a depression, as you know, the agricultural depression that extended all during the 20s because the price of land depressed mm-hmm. price of agricultural products. So we were accustomed to it. We were far from prosperous. And it's sort of the impact of the stock market crash of 29, except that, well, we saw many of our banks had folded in the 1923-24, and that winter of 1923-24, so we were used to that kind of thing.
So you really didn't feel it was anything new?
No, it was nothing new, and the impact of 29, I don't think, was felt that greatly. While I was in college my last year, of course, when FDR took office and then closed the banks, that was rather precarious for a few days because our checks wouldn't move.
Mm-hmm. Which reminds me, what did it cost you to go to college? Well, speaking of money.
That was very, very, very little. You generally pay, what is it, $7? Must have been $7 a week or a month. Must have been a month. $7 a month for a room, $6 or $7, maybe as low as $5. You'd pay your fee when you registered. I think at that time it was only $10. Later on, I believe it was $20 in the later 30s. But at that time, I think it was only $10. Maybe
for a semester or a quarter?
Yeah, and that was primarily fees. There wasn't any tuition as such, but that covered all of our fees.
Did you still rent books, or did you purchase books at that time?
We didn't rent them. They were friendly.
Or assigned,
no, we did not purchase books.
They were assigned.
We checked them out of the library. Mm-hmm. Actually, they have a special kind of a deal. They check them out to you. There were occasional books, like a chemistry manual you'd have to buy, but very little of that, mm-hmm. almost none. Mm-hmm. And the problem then was food, and food was a cheap problem. Actually, many of us would bring our food from home, and if we could get back, and we fed ourselves that way, and we lived on practically nothing, went through college on almost nothing. The boys, some of the athletes, while I was in college, the first of the Michigan gang came. That they succeeded the Montana sheep herders, because there were four or five of them came through looking for college. They were from Ron Bessemer, most of the town of Bessemer, Ironwood, and they were athletes and they wanted to go to college. And Sliv Nemzik spotted them and said, "Well, you can live down here at the armory." And, basement, or there's a room upstairs, and you can live there free, and you can get in the National Guard, and you'll make $1 or $1.50 a week or something like that. They get paid for their practice. That was real hard money.
Now, was this back in the years you were an undergraduate, or was that a little later?
Yeah. No,
I've heard about Slim's Army, but I assumed it came about 10 years after that.
No, that was then.
Okay.
And Sliv, I think, reorganized the National Guard in 1926. I told this story in the Century Together, the martyred part of the Century Together, but I think it was the National Guard had really fallen. There had been an earlier company started back in World War I days, but it had sort of deteriorated, and the people in Morehead were thought something ought to be done about it. So Sliv took it over and really made it into a very good company, Company F at that time, and they had a statewide reputation. They'd go to encampments and they'd have various activities, and they always won the track meets. They'd hold those things. All of his athletes were in the National Guard. They weren't all made up of Sliv's football and basketball players. Sliv, by the way, coached everything. That's why he couldn't coach tennis, so he'd give me $10. I would coach. I played number one position and coached them at the same time.
So you coached tennis
while
you were in college,
isn't
that something?
Yeah. And we played. We played the college around us, and we get on state tournament. We get on St. Cloud, or going up to Bemidji, somehow to Jamestown.
So the sports were football, basketball, tennis?
Yeah, we didn't have any baseball. Actually, it was a little informal, hockey or baseball sometimes, but those were not really...
Were there women's sports?
No, they did play in connection with their physical... I don't believe they had any competitive...
There wasn't any competitive
sport. Always
played volleyball and things like
Well, they had a field... They played... I remember seeing them play field hockey. Now, whether they played in competition, they might have a little bit with NDSU or Concordia.
But sports, competition sports,
no,
was a male occupation.
Sport. It was strictly a male occupation, right.
Well, back to Slim's Army.
We didn't have any gym.
You had no gym, except for that little one-story addition to Weld Hall or whatever.
Well, that wasn't a gym. That was a general purpose building, but it was not a gym. You could have some physical education in there, calisthenics, but we had to use the armory. Yeah. And that's where they'd all are practicing. And that's where they play the games. But of course, while I was here, the college was being rebuilt. You see, the reason I mentioned Johnny Ingersoll first as being so extraordinarily dynamic was there was a real question as to whether the college should be rebuilt. Minnesota was in not very healthy financial situation, and there was a strong movement on. So, well, the building's burned now. Why don't we discontinue that? But they don't need teachers. There's a glut of teachers anyway, and why continue that teachers' college? And of course, you had to stir up a good deal of local sentiment. The alumni organization got organized. I guess they had a slim organization for them, but they became very dynamic. They raised some money, bought some houses nearby that they were actually on what is now the campus, and were used entirely, I guess, for the campus school. Because the campus school, the model school had been called earlier, was a very important aspect of the college. All our practice teaching was done there. And the first school was the kindergarten and first and second grade, and then the third, fourth, and fifth grade, and then so on.
Did students come from Moorhead to that school and make the choice to go there rather than to the public school? Or were some of them to the campus school? Yeah.
I'm not absolutely clear as to how the students were chosen there. As you know, there are a great many Moorhead people. You talk to them now, said, oh yeah, we were in the kindergarten or first grade, went to school at the campus school. Yes, I think it had considerable prestige because the supervising teachers had master's degrees from good institutions, and they were very advanced and very, very skillful. So it was considered perhaps the best education available in the two communities. So a great many people did send their youngsters to the...
But there was no boarding school or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
No. Mm-hmm. And for us, of course, we practiced on them.
How much practice teaching did you have to do?
It seems to me we had to have... It was taken just as another subject when I was going to school. You would...
Your junior or senior year or every
ordinarily.
Year?
Ordinarily. I did one when I was a sophomore. I got credit, I think, for what I'd had, my actual experience. I think you're supposed to have three different practice teaching experiences, which meant that you'd take... Your normal load was four classes, four four-hour classes. And you would take in a junior and senior year, usually in senior year, each quarter, I think that's when you're supposed to do it. You would take three regular classes, and then you would do one student teaching stint. For instance, if your major was English and your minors were French and history, you would, one term, you would practice teach maybe the high school juniors in English. Next term, you might have the high school seniors in French, and next time...
So the campus school went all the way through high school by that time?
Yeah, it went through high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a small high school, mm-hmm. and not... It was just emerging. It, too, was beginning... I started their first newspaper at the campus school, for instance, with a mimeograph thing. Mm-hmm. But they had, even though they were small... And Moorhead High was very well known, a very good institution.
When you say small, what do you mean?
Well, there was comparatively few students, very small classes.
What would you say, 50 or in the total school?
In the whole total high school, I suppose, something like that, because you would teach classes all the way from four students to maybe a dozen or 15 in
mm-hmm,
class.
Mm-hmm.
They were small, very small high school classes.
Yes. What a wonderful teaching situation.
Yeah, it was. You could do some interesting things.
Now, I take it your majors were English and your minors were French and history, since
yeah, they
you bring
were.
Those up as
yeah.
possibilities.
Yeah, right. Virginia Grantham made me promise that I got technically a minor in French, which meant I had 2 years of French, that I would never undertake to teach French, because she knew that my second year, she was quite... She usually had a very good high standards, but I was so involved with extracurricular activities that I just couldn't do justice to my second year of French, and she knew that it wasn't as good as it should have been. I had almost a double major. I lacked only one subject for a major in history,
mm-hmm.
which uh, I didn't worry about because I knew I couldn't get a job teaching history anyway. That was, they'd always hire some coach, football or basketball coach, and hand him a history book, and then he'd teach history.
But English was always a prime subject.
I suppose. History was the other one. I was just as much interested in history and in political science, I guess. But literature, English was promised a much better chance for finding jobs.
Well, to go
and
back,
I became more and more interested in literature, of course, all along.
Yes. Now, was Byron Murray the chief professor in literature as well as journalism?
No, Maud Hayes was. She was chairman of the department. Mm-hmm. Maud Hayes retired at the end of the 30s, and then Byron Murray succeeded. Delcy Holmquist and Ethel Tainer were the other two.
Now, Delcy came in about 1929, didn't she?
She came 29, yeah. Mm-hmm. And she taught... And Ethel Tainer taught the speech courses, all of them.
Well, now, Delcy had, of course, a long and distinguished career at this institution mm-hmm. as well. What was she like in her first years here as a young instructor?
Oh, she was I never had her as an instructor.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Oh, okay.
My sister did, and said she was a marvelous instructor. And she had a fine reputation as an instructor. But when I was here... she played she was gone, I think, doing some graduate work one
She went back to Colorado, I think.
Yeah. But she did not play later on when I came back to teach here, it was something else. But in those early years, Delcy was not taking a very active role as far as the student's concerned. In mm-hmm. the classroom, as a fine teacher, mm-hmm. but not in any other way. She mm-hmm. was, she'd been here too short a time, perhaps, and was not involved with the extracurricular activities as some of the others were. So she was not a prominent figure in the college in those earliest years.
Well, we wove around a little bit, but we were talking for a minute about after the fire and how the college mm-hmm. managed to survive it. And you mm-hmm. say that the alums, for one, organized and got money to get the campus school back together.
Yeah.
John Ingersoll was important with the students. Mm-hmm. Who was active on the faculty? Who was the resident director at the time, and what did he do to help things along?
Not a very dynamic one. I can't remember who it was, to tell the truth. It could have been McCubry. But whoever it was not an effective one. I had a very effective one earlier. O.J. Hagen had been resident rector in the 20s, but he by that time was a regent at the University of Minnesota. Now, I may have had some muscle, and of course he had the best interests of the college at heart because he, after all, he'd married President Weld's daughter, Roselle Weld. But you know, the one that perhaps I would say the people who more than anyone else have saved the college would have been Sliv Nemzik and Johnny Ingersoll. Sliv, I think, was perhaps more conservative. At that time, the governor of Minnesota was Floyd Olson. The farm labor rights had finally won. And Floyd Olson was just at the beginning of his very dynamic career, a very strong figure. Sliv suddenly changed his politics and became a farm laborite temporarily. No question, didn't make any bones about it. Uh-huh. But it was a politics of convenience in order to, his politics, as mine were the good of the college, of course, first and foremost. And now Floyd Olson needed some help because the labor unions were strong enough in the cities that the which group was it? One of the groups, the truckers or someone like that, were striking in the cities, were threatening a tie up the Twin Cities. They were led by a very left-wing group, the Dunn Brothers, the three Dunn Brothers who were actually Trotskyites. And they were challenging his... Now, this was a very curious situation. Like, here was a farmer laborer, a very left-leaning... a governor, and here these labor people were challenging his authority. Now, he couldn't stand for that.